Hello and welcome to this week's dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2 FM up there in Preston, on Birmingham, Unity FM, 93.5 FM in the Midlands, and on Radio Verulam in St Albans. Coming up in today's show, we have Anthea Page in conversation with Karen Della Penna, an actress and theatre director from New York.
Our guest this week is BBC's Martin Evans, who talks to Alex Milne about his alter ego as Twinkle Toes, the WWE USA wrestler. Tony Gosling is also here. He's going to do a live question and answer session. The topic is the connection between our local power stations and Osama bin Laden, no less. There's poetry from Angie Belcher coming up later, and as usual, Jeff Sparks will be presenting his What's On Guide. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis.
Karen Della Penna was educated at the Arts Education School in London. Now she's a successful actress and a theatre director in New York. Last summer, she had a very successful one-man show at the Edinburgh Fringe called The Fly. In this interview, Karen talks to Anthea Page about what it was like to arrive in New York to start a new life and what it was like to be in America in the 1970s. So we take a bit of a nostalgic look back in time in there. So to set the mood, here is Simon & Garfunkel with their song America.
You're going to tell us about the 1970s in America.
My personal story, Karin's personal story, was that I arrived in New York City in 1973 and was completely bewitched by the city. I was warned against it by all my friends in New York, in England. They said, oh my God, you're going to have a terrible time. It's going to be awful, awful, awful. And I came over and I felt like I had been filled with air and light as soon as I saw the city. It was an extraordinary experience. I hadn't experienced it anywhere else, and I'd already done a lot of traveling by then. And I've continued to feel that way all the way along, even though I've lived in New York and, I mean, in California and other places. I always feel that way when I come back to New York. Anyway, so I arrived in, I think it was August of 73, and things were really bubbling then with the hippie life. I mean, there was a place called McSorley's, which was this Irish bar. The floor was covered in sawdust and basically beer, and there was nobody with short hair, male or female, then. Everybody was, you know, totally decked out as hippies and beads and the whole thing. And sure, there was a lot of drugs around, but it didn't seem, in my experience, to be that overwhelming. It was just sort of part of the culture. It was part of the makeup of the wood, of the sawdust, of the air that you breathed. It was just part of it. The whole fabric of the city was just vibrating with the music of the day and the general effort to in the direction of peace, love, and happiness. Although in fact it was already, there was a lot of disillusion going on, because that was post-Watergate by the time I arrived, and it was getting pretty tough as far as Nixon and the administration goes. But nonetheless, it was a very exciting time to be in the city. The city was getting close to being broke at that time, and it was becoming increasingly shabby, and there was a lot of crime around. But I managed to be very safe in that city. I never had the slightest problem. I remember once getting lost on the subway and ending up in the heart of Harlem. And I was staying with friends who were very, very New York and very intimidated by Harlem. And they were terrified when they heard I'd been there. But in fact, I was just hunky-dory. I was perfectly comfortable, and nobody made a fuss about anything. So, okay, well, what I remember about fashion, other than obvious hippie things, is what I was wearing, because I was a very young woman then. It was all about me. And I do remember that I had these bright orange stacked heels, you know, whatever they call, I forget what they call now, but the sole of the shoe was, you know, about a foot high, and then the heel was about 2 foot high. And I had this lime green and bright orange striped suit, jacket and pants that I had bought in Paris. I mean, it was super high fashion. It was really cool. When I look at it now, it's just terrifying. I have pictures of it. The rest, I remember, if we were going to really get into the details, I married to stay in the country because I wanted to stay in the U.S. And I wore this kind of striped, it was sort of bands of colored flowers that went on this and kind of flowed around with this full-length skirt. Oh. And I had like a Heidi braids around my head. I still have the picture of getting married like that and wearing a little bouquet. I mean, I have pictures of myself back then. It's not much use for radio, but it was just about wearing very little makeup, if any at all, and having hair that sort of fell all over your face. And one of the idols of the day was Jacqueline Bisset, who really didn't dress like that, but she had that kind of sultry quality, and people aspired to that. What people ate, I mean, I think more and more people were moving towards being macrobiotic in that time. I'm just trying to think what else. I mean, the music was... Hendrix still was prevalent, even though he was dead by then, and Joplin was still prevalent, even though she was dead by then, and the Beatles were no longer together, but they were still prevalent, and of course the Stones, most of these people lived in America by that time. I remember seeing Mick Jagger walking down the street. And the movies that were out... Oh, well, of course there was Five Easy Pieces, The Godfather... trilogy was happening around that time. There was the one where Marlon Brando used butter. Last Tango in Paris. There was Midnight Cowboy, which, I mean, that happened just before I moved to the U.S., but oh my God, was that a definitive movie. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. The movies that were very popular at the time, even though they came out earlier, were very avant-garde films like Buñuel's film, Louis Buñuel. The mayor of New York at the time was a man called John Lindsay, who was sort of a version of JFK. He was very beautiful, very blonde, very waspish. I think he was a pretty useless mayor. Please don't sue me, anybody who knows John Lindsay. But I think he was known as a very, very telegenic mayor who, when he got in, didn't really do much for the city. In fact, I think it's possible, I'm nervous about saying this, but I think it's possible that the city went closer and closer to bankruptcy under his reign. But he was lovely. He was very well liked. After him, I think Ed Koch came in. And he was around for a long time. He's still around. He still does television interviews, but he's no longer the mayor. But the politics, I mean, when I was in New York, Nixon was still around. And the whole Watergate thing was blowing up. And everybody was up in arms about it. The Vietnam War was beginning. I mean, ironically, it was Nixon. It was under Nixon's regime that the Vietnam War ended. By the time I got to the States, the Vietnam War was winding up, and I think the escape from Saigon happened around the 73, but my history is not very solid on that. Because I came from England, I was much less acutely aware of the Vietnam War than had I been raised in the States. The man I married to stay in the country was, he managed not to get drafted. He had a high number, I think, in the draft. So that meant that he wouldn't get drafted. But he was very much an armchair philosopher and was extremely heated about all of that. The music, of course, spoke a lot to that era. Bob Dylan, the Eagles, the Chicago. I'm trying to think of all these huge bands from that time who had a political leaning.
What about Frank Zappa?
Well, Frank Zappa... I didn't really listen to Frank Zappa because he was a little too progressive for me. Now I listen to him, I think he's absolutely brilliant, but in those days he wasn't accessible to me. The people I would listen to was music that I could sing along to, and it was hard for me to sing along to Frank Zappa. But no, he was extraordinary. Is he still alive? Is Frank Zappa still... No, he died, didn't he? He was extremely progressive and... But I'm afraid I'm a bit of a useless interviewee as far as popular music goes, because pretty quickly after I moved out of my generation, which was sort of the Beatles and the Stones, I started listening to jazz and blues, which was my preferred kind of music. And I didn't really listen very much to popular music, I'm afraid. Of course, there was Elton John. He was coming along He was very popular. But I mean, yeah, exactly. He's kind of sappy, you know. But he was around. I remember he was around. And, oh, I mean, disco was happening in the early 70s. It was already happening. And I hate that to this day. It makes my teeth ache. But it was happening. It was what was on the airways, which is probably one of the reasons I was chased off the popular music airways and went to jazz and blues more.
That was Karen de la Pena talking about America and New York in the 70s.
Staying on the theme of America, Alec Milne met up with BBC radio presenter Martin Evans, who has another life in the States as a professional wrestler and broadcaster, Twinkle Toes. The music is Bomber by Motorhead.
This is Alec Milne. I'm at the BBC Radio Bristol, and I'm speaking to Martin Evans, and the conversation is about wrestling journey. Martin, I believe that wasn't your name on this particular wrestling journey into America.
No, it wasn't. No, I managed to somehow evolve into the weird and wild and wacky world of professional wrestling. And over there, it's all about gimmicks. It's all about over the top and the extraordinary. So if you've got a bland, boring name, it doesn't really cut it. So the creative geniuses over there came up with the name for me. And it was a process of about an hour's conversation. And they got asked me lots of questions and things like that. And they found that I was quite flexible with the legs. I can kick tops of door frames and things like that. And yeah, I'm a big guy. I'm about 22 stone. So they said, bit of a Twinkle Toes. And that stuck. So my wrestling name became known as Twinkle Toes. And it evolved from there. Most people now know me as Twink.
All right. So you were actually doing wrestling.
Well, I'm a broadcaster, so I was doing wrestling broadcasting.
All right.
But I presented two live television shows every week. But, of course, you've got 5 days left. And when you're not with family or your friends, you make the wrestlers your friends after a while. And it was a very close-knit family. And they more or less taught me everything I needed to do. They train every day. So I got in there and trained with them and learned all the moves and learned how to go through tables and things like that. So, yeah, over the course of about 3 years, I learned how to wrestle quite proficiently. Mm-hmm. And it all went from there.
Now, my experience of wrestling in this country goes back to the days of Kent Walton.
Good old Kent Walton and Kent Big Walton, Daddy and Big Daddy, Giant Haystacks.
That's it.
Some of the legends, Jackie Palo.
Jackie Palo, yeah.
Yeah.
Is it a similar scene in America?
Oh, no, it's a lot much more over the top. It's more glitz, it's more glamour. But that's where I started. That's where my love of wrestling first started. 12 o'clock every Saturday, I would run at the fish and chip shop and dash back to catch World of Sport and sit there with my nan. And it was more my nan's reactions to what she was seeing that enthralled me to begin with than the actual wrestling itself, because now she would get on her knees and she was in her 80s, she'd scream at the telly, she'd throw her handbag and really react. And I'm just so interested in the way that my nan was reacting to what she saw, and I thought, wow, if I could motivate people to get a reaction out of them as well like that, then that would be a dream come true. So that was what started my love of wrestling. And of course WWE came into the UK about 25 years ago, something like that, 20 years ago. Very late in the morning, like something like 3 in the morning on ITV, there was a one-hour show called Superstars of Wrestling. And I saw it in the newspaper, and I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. And I was very much expecting it to be a documentary style on Big Daddy or something like that. But I thought, well, that would probably fascinate me. So I taped it on the Betamax and watched it back the next day. And what I saw the next day blew my mind away, really. It was glitz, it was glamour, it was over-the-top rope action. It was something I'd never seen before. And then that's what got my fascination started with American wrestling.
And who were some of the characters in the American wrestling scene?
Oh, back then it was the Hulk Hogans and the Ultimate Warriors and the Macho Mans. You know, real different names. The Big Boss Man, people like that. The African Dream, all those wonderful names. And some of them are still around today and very much active in the wrestling scene. But some of the big names of today would be things like John Cena, The Rock, and people like that, Randy Orton. Very much the celebrities of today.
The actual performance that you do, is it the wrestling itself? How is it structured?
Well, two men get in the ring and they beat each other up, basically. you have to watch it to really appreciate it, although there is a lot of psychology involved in it as well. As a casual fan, you wouldn't appreciate the actual amount of psychology, the amount of scientific knowledge that goes into producing a great wrestling match. You think people just get in there, throw fists and drop kicks and things like that, but there's a lot more to it than that. It's a wonderful art form, I think.
I've watched things like Greco-Roman Olympic wrestling. It's completely different.
Oh, that's boring, Greco-Roman wrestling. Yeah, it's just two men on a mat trying to pin each other's shoulders. I want to see fireworks, I want to see music, I want to see performance, I want to see all the things that are involved in the escapism as a fan. And as a professional working on the other side of the curtain, I want to be able to understand what's going on, understand the storylines that are evolving to get us to the fight in the first place.
How much of it is theatre and how much of it is sport?
Well, I can tell you, lots of people get injured. And in my first week in there, I suffered more or less a broken collarbone, a severe concussion.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, there's no messing around. You've got to know what you're doing, otherwise you're going to get seriously hurt. And that's why they always tell the children that are watching, don't try this at home, because you can really, really seriously hurt yourself. Trust is another massive issue in wrestling as well, because there are people throwing you around. You know, if they just slightly get it wrong, you know, they're trying to hurt you, but if they get it slightly wrong, they could kill you. So trust is a massive issue.
It's a big money event, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's huge. Yeah. Well, it depends where you go. I mean, some people are desperately trying to get to... WWE is where it's all at, basically. That's a global phenomenon that's just watched by a billion people across the globe in almost every country in the world. A live show goes out every Monday night, for example, all across the globe. So it's also going to be a big money earner. But people desperately trying to get there, probably one in every thousand that want to get there, don't. And they're sort of like working for $30 a night if they're lucky. Some people work for free for years just to get noticed and, you know, perfect what they do. If you can get to the golden land, which is World Wrestling Entertainments, and perform in front of a global stage, then you know you've made it and you know you've had a great journey.
So let me take you back to America. What parts of America did you visit?
Oh, which places haven't I visited would
really?
Be quicker to tell you, yeah. I was based predominantly in Louisville, Kentucky. That was the main base. Then then the base changed to Tampa, Florida, which is the main base. But literally, you, every day you're in a car traveling to the next town or the next village or the next state. And if you're not in a car, you're on an aeroplane. And every state loves it. And it's more or less a traveling circus. So you do your television shows every week, but you also do your non-televised events as well. And that can be anywhere in the states, indeed now anywhere in the world. It's a wonderful thing.
And do you still do this?
Well, yeah, I'm currently based in Bristol as a broadcaster, but my heart is very much in America still. I'm very much in contact with the boys over there, and I probably will be going back in about 6 months' time. I've got to get physically fit before I get back. They don't take you if you've got a bit of puppy fat on, and I've been overindulging in the May Day bank holiday festivities, one too many barbecues. Back to the gym very, very shortly, get myself toned up, won't take very long. And then back to the wonderful world that is professional wrestling, and back to the wacky catchphrases as well. Like, if you don't know what to think, just think twink. And with Twinkle Toes, anything goes.
Martin Evans, otherwise known as Twinkle Toes, thank you very much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
That was Alec Milner in conversation with BBC's Martin Evans, otherwise known as Twinkle Toes, who also has a MySpace site. Just look up Think Twink.
What is the connection between Aldbury and Hinkley Point nuclear power stations and last week's assassination of Osama bin Laden by US Navy SEALs? Well, to answer that conundrum, I'm joined by Dalek's Tony Gosling. Hello.
Hi, John. Well, it is stretching a point a bit, but really it's the nuclear connection, because actually all nuclear power is really about producing plutonium for nuclear weapons. And we heard last week through WikiLeaks that Al-Qaeda are threatening that if Osama bin Laden is captured or killed, as of course he was last weekend, according to the Americans anyway, that they will explode a nuclear bomb on the European continent. Now, this has to be taken with a pinch of salt, because it was information supposedly extracted under torture. But anyway, that's the sort of slightly loose connection.
So if they kill Osama bin Laden, they will explode a nuclear bomb somewhere on the...
That is what Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and potentially others have said.
After they shot...
But remember, this is information extracted under torture.
Well, yeah, that's very true.
But
yeah,
it was quite weird to have this in The Guardian on Tuesday and then to have bin Laden killed, supposedly anyway, on Sunday.
Okay, so in light of this knowledge, they then go ahead and sort of shoot him, what, to sort of test their...
Well, I actually think this is much more to do with a big fallout between the CIA and the ISI, that's the American Intelligence Services, and the Pakistani Intelligence Services,
yes,
after the Pakistanis kicked the CIA out of Pakistan for having one of their agents, Raymond Davis, discovered giving chemical weapons and nuclear weapons to the Taliban, which was quite a naughty thing for him to be doing. So that's why the Pakistanis kicked him out.
Okay. And what specifically links these nuclear weapons and the fact that we have Aldbury and Hinkley Point up the road?
Well, I'm just really talking about how all of these nuclear power stations produce plutonium, and the plutonium is therefore then used in nuclear weapons. And really, they're totally uneconomic other than that they produce plutonium, which the military love.
Is there any evidence that nuclear weapons have gone missing that might lead us to think, aha, Al-Qaeda might actually have one?
Well, actually, there is, because in 1992... the South African government had developed nuclear A-bombs, that is, as opposed to the much more powerful hydrogen bombs, with the Israelis. And they had several of these that they wanted to actually get rid of on the black market because they didn't want the black majority government in South Africa to have a nuclear capability.
Right.
And as part of all that, there was a bunch of Tory grandees, including, incidentally, David Cameron, who were involved in trying to get these sold on the black market. Unfortunately, they lost them. Even though they got the money, they lost the bombs.
What is the evidence for that?
Well, there's quite a lot of evidence that these bombs were circulating. Certainly that there was one of them was exploded as a test in Prince Edward Island. And also the North Koreans exploded one of these that is believed to have been one of these particular bombs in May 2009.
Okay, and lastly, where can people research this story further on the internet?
Well, look up Peter Eyre, who's a former intelligence officer, E-Y-R-E, and he's written a very interesting article which explains this very much more fully and with all the references. And the title, the headline, is US and UK lost three nuclear weapons each.
Okay. For many people, they find nuclear power stations shrouded in secrecy. We're not supposed to understand what's going on inside. But to understand, you only really need a rudimentary knowledge of O-level or GCSE physics. So with that in mind, let's have a listen to Australian jargon buster, medical doctor and paediatrician Helen Caldicott.
When you fission uranium, 200 new elements are formed, all of which are much more poisonous to the body than the original uranium. Although uranium's pretty poisonous, America used it in Fallujah and Baghdad, and in Fallujah, 80% of the babies being born are grossly deformed. They're being born without brains, single eyes, no arms. The doctors have told the women to stop having babies. The incidence of childhood cancer has gone up about 12 times. This is genocide, it's a nuclear war being conducted in Iraq. But uranium that they're using lasts for more than 4.5 billion years. So we're contaminating the cradle of civilization, the coalition of the willing. In the nuclear power plants, however, is a huge amount of radiation, 200 elements. Some last seconds, some last millions of years. Radioactive iodine lasts 6 weeks. It causes thyroid cancer. That's why people are saying better take potassium iodide, because that blocks the thyroid uptake of radioactive iodine, which later can cause thyroid cancer. In Chernobyl, over 20,000 people have developed thyroid cancer. They have to have their thyroids out, and they will die unless they take thyroid replacement every day, like a diabetic has to take insulin. Strontium-90 will get out. It lasts for 600 years. It goes to the bone where it causes bone cancer or leukemia. Cesium lasts for 600 years. It's all over Europe. 40% of Europe is still radioactive. Turkish food is extremely radioactive. Do not buy Turkish dried apricots. Do not buy Turkish hazelnuts. The Turks were so cross with the Russians, they sent all their radioactive tea over to Russia after Chernobyl. But 40% of Europe is still radioactive. Farms in Britain, their lambs are so full of cesium they can't sell them. Don't eat European food. But that's nothing compared to what's happening now. One of the most deadly is plutonium, named after Pluto, god of the underworld. 1/1,000,000th of a gram, if you inhale it, will give you cancer. Hypothetically, 1 pound, if evenly distributed, could give everyone on Earth cancer. Each reactor has 250 kilos of plutonium in it. You only need 2.5 kilograms to make a bomb, because plutonium is what they make bombs with. It's the only country that has a reactor. From your uranium, you are the biggest exporters of uranium in the world, Cameco. Canada sells two things. It sells wheat for life and uranium for death. Plutonium is going to get out and spread all over the Northern Hemisphere, and it's already heading towards North America now. Plus, Radioactive iodine 129, its half-life is 17 million years, plus strontium, plus cesium, plus tritium, and I could go on and on and on. When it rains, down comes fallout, and it concentrates in food. If it gets into the sea, the algae concentrated hundreds of times, then the crustaceans concentrated hundreds of times, then the little fish, then the big fish, then us. Because we stand on the apex of the food chain. You can't taste these radioactive elements, you can't see them, and you can't smell them. They're silent. When you get them inside your body, you don't suddenly drop dead of cancer. It takes 5 to 60 years to get your cancer. And when the cancer, if you feel a lump in your breast, doesn't say, I was made by some strontium 90 you ate in a piece of fish 20 years ago. All radiation is damaging. It's cumulative. Each dose you get adds to your risk of getting cancer. With americium, that's more dangerous than plutonium. I mean, I could go on and on. Depends if it rains, if you're going to get it or not. If it rains and the radiation comes down, don't grow food, don't eat the food, and I mean don't eat it for 600 years. The radioactive waste from nuclear power is going to be buried, I hear, just like next to Lake Ontario. It's going to leak, last for millions of years. It's going to get into the water, into the food chains. Radioactive waste will induce epidemics of cancer, leukemia, and genetic disease for the rest of time. This is the greatest public health hazard the world has ever witnessed, apart from the threat every day of nuclear war. Einstein said the splitting of the atom changed everything save man's mode of thinking. Very profound. Thus we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe. We are arrogant, we have a lot of hubris, and I think the reptilian midbrain of some men's brains is pathological. We are now in a situation where we have harnessed the energy of the sun. It is totally out of control, and there's simply nothing we can do about it.
Australian jog and buster, medical doctor and paediatrician Helen Caldicott.
And now Malcolm Grieve reads part two of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. The music is from the Pastoral Symphony by Vaughan Williams.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 1, The Old Buccaneer. Chapter 2, Black Dog Appears and Disappears. It was not very long after this that there occurred the first of the mysterious events that rid us at last of the captain, though not, as you will see, of his affairs. It was a bitter, cold winter, with long, hard frosts and heavy gales. And it was plain from the first that my poor father was little likely to see the spring. He sank daily, and my mother and I had all the in upon our hands, and we were kept busy enough, without paying much regard to our unpleasant guest. It was one January morning, very early, a pinching, frosty morning, the cove all grey with hoarfrost, the ripple lapping softly on the stones, the sun still low, and only touching the hilltops, and shining far to seaward. The captain had risen earlier than usual, and set out down the beach, his cutlass swinging under the broad skirts of the old blue coat, his brass telescope under his arm, his hat tilted back upon his head. I remember his breath hanging like smoke in his wake as he strode off, and the last sound I heard of him, as he turned the big rock, was a loud snort of indignation, as though his mind was still running upon Dr. Livesey. Well, Mother was upstairs with Father, and I was laying the breakfast table against the captain's return when the parlour door opened, and a man stepped in on whom I had never set my eyes before. He was a pale, tallowy creature, wanting two fingers of the left hand, and though he wore a cutlass, he did not look much like a fighter. I had always my eye open for seafaring men, with one leg or two, and I remember this one puzzled me. He was not sailorly, and yet he had a smack of the sea about him too. I asked him what was for his service, and he said he would take rum, but as I was going out of the room to fetch it, he sat down upon a table and motioned me to draw near. I paused where I was with my napkin in my hand. "Come here, sonny," says he. "Come nearer here." I took a step nearer. "Is this here table for my mate, Bill?" he asked with a kind of a leer. I told him I did not know his mate, Bill, and this was for a person who stayed in our house, whom we called the captain. "Well," he said, "my mate, Bill, would be called the captain, as like as not. He has a cut upon one cheek, and a mighty pleasant way with him, particularly in drink. As my mate, Bill, we'll put it for argument like, that your captain has a cut upon one cheek, and we'll put it, if you like, that that cheek's the right one." "Oh, well, I told you. Now, is my mate Bill in this here house?" I told him he was out walking. "Which way, sonny? Which way's he gone?" And when I had pointed out the rock and told him how the captain was likely to return and how soon, and answered a few other questions, "Ah," said he, "this will be as good as drink to my mate Bill." The expression of his face as he said these words was not at all pleasant, and I had my own reasons for thinking that the stranger was mistaken, even supposing he meant what he said. But it was no affair of mine, I thought, and besides it was difficult to know what to do. The stranger kept hanging about just inside the inn door, peering around the corner like a cat waiting for a mouse. Once I stepped out myself into the road, but he immediately called me back. And as I did not obey quick enough for his fancy, a most horrible change came over his tallowy face, and he ordered me in with an oath that made me jump. As soon as I was back again, he returned to his former manner, half fawning, half sneering, patted me on the shoulder, told me I was a good boy, and he had taken quite a fancy to me. "I have a son of my own," said he, "as like you as two blocks, and he's all the pride of my heart. But the great thing for boys is discipline, sonny, discipline. Now, if you had sailed along of Bill, you wouldn't have stood there to be spoke to twice. Not you. That was never Bill's way, nor the way of sich as sailed with him. And here, sure enough, is my mate Bill, with a spyglass under his arm. Bless his old heart, to be sure. You and me will just go back into the parlour, sonny, and get behind the door, and we'll give Bill a little surprise. Bless his heart, I say again." So saying, the stranger backed along with me into the parlour and put me behind him in the corner, so that we were both hidden by the open door. I was very uneasy and alarmed, as you may fancy, and it rather added to my fears to observe that the stranger was certainly frightened himself. He cleared the hilt of his cutlass and loosened the blade in its sheath. And all the time we were waiting there, he kept swallowing as if he felt what we used to call a lump in the throat. At last, in strode the captain, slammed the door behind him without looking to the right or the left, and marched straight across the room to where his breakfast awaited him. "Bill," said the stranger in a voice that I thought he had tried to make bold and big. The captain spun round on his heel and fronted us. All the brown had gone out of his face, and even his nose was blue. He had the look of a man who sees a ghost, or the evil one, or something worse, if anything can be. And upon my word, I felt sorry to see him all in a moment turn so old and sick. Come, Bill. You know me. You know an old shipmate, Bill. Surely, said the stranger. The captain made a sort of gasp. Black dog, said he. And who else? Returned the other, getting more at his ease. Black dog, as ever was. Comfort to see his old shipmate Billy at the Admiral Benbow Inn. Ah, Bill, Bill. We've seen a sight of times, us two, since I lost them two talons. Holding up his mutilated hand. Now look here, said the captain. You've run me down. Well then, speak up. What is it? That's you, Bill, returned Black Dog. You're in the right of it, Billy. I'll have a glass of rum from this dear child here, as I've took such a liking to, and we'll sit down, if you please, and talk square. Like old shipmates. When I returned with the rum, they were already seated on either side of the captain's breakfast table. Black Dog next to the door, and sitting sideways, so as to have one eye on his old shipmate, and one, as I thought, on his retreat. He bade me go and leave the door wide open. None of your keyholes for me, sonny, he said, and I left them together and retired into the bar. For a long time, though I certainly did my best to listen, I could hear nothing but a low gabbling. But at last the voices began to grow higher, and I could pick up a word or two, mostly oaths from the captain.
No, 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 and an end of it, he cried once,
and again,
if it comes to swinging, swing all, say I.
Then all of a sudden there was a tremendous explosion of oaths and other noises. The chair and table went over in a lump, a clash of steel followed, and then a cry of pain. And the next instant I saw Black Dog in full flight, and the captain hotly pursuing, both with drawn cutlasses, and the former streaming blood from the left shoulder. Just at the door, the captain aimed at the fugitive one last tremendous cut, which would certainly have split him to the chine had it not been intercepted by our big signboard of the Admiral Benbow. You may see the notch on the lower side of the frame to this day. That blow was the last of the battle. Once out upon the road, Black Dog, in spite of his wound, showed a wonderful clean pair of heels and disappeared over the edge of the hill in half a minute. The captain, for his part, stood staring at the signboard like a bewildered man. Then he passed his hand over his eyes several times, and at last turned back into the house. Jim, says he, rum. And as he spoke, he reeled a little, and caught himself with one hand against the wall. Are you hurt? Cried I. Rum, he repeated.
I must get away from here. Rum. Rum!
I ran to fetch it, but I was quite unsteadied by all that had fallen out, and I broke one glass and fouled the tap, and while I was still getting in my own way, I heard a loud fall in the parlour, and running in, beheld the captain lying full length upon the floor. At the same instant, my mother, alarmed by the cries and fighting, came running downstairs to help me. Between us, we raised his head. He was breathing very loud and hard, but his eyes were closed, and his face a horrible colour. "Deary, deary me!" cried my mother. "What a disgrace upon the house, and your poor father sick!" In the meantime, we had no idea what to do to help the captain, nor any other thought but that he had got his death hurt in the scuffle with the stranger. I got the rum, to be sure, and tried to put it down his throat, but his teeth were tightly shut, and his jaws as strong as iron. It was a happy relief for us when the door opened and Dr. Livesey came in on his visit to my father. "Oh, doctor," we cried, "what shall we do? Where is he wounded?"
"Wounded? A fiddlestick's end," said the doctor. "No more wounded than you or I. This man has had a stroke, as I warned him. Now, Mrs. Hawkins, just you run upstairs to your husband and tell him, if possible, nothing about it. For my part, I must do my best to save this fellow's trebly worthless life. And Jim here will get me a basin." When I got back with the basin, the doctor had already ripped up the captain's sleeve and exposed his great, sinewy arm. It was tattooed in several places. His luck. A fair wind. And Billy Bones' his fancy were very neatly and clearly executed on the forearm. And up near the shoulder, there was a sketch of a gallows and a man hanging from it, done, as I thought, with great spirit. "Prophetic," said the doctor, touching this picture with his finger. "And now, Master Billy Bones, if that be your name, we'll have a look at the colour of your blood. Jim," he said, "are you afraid of blood?" "No, sir," said I. "Well then," said he, "you hold the basin." And with that, he took his lancet and opened a vein. A great deal of blood was taken before the captain opened his eyes and looked mistily about him. First he recognised the doctor with an unmistakable frown, but then his glance fell upon me, and he looked relieved. But suddenly his colour changed, and he tried to raise himself, crying, "Where's Black Dog?" "There is no Black Dog here," said the doctor, "except what you have on your own back. You have been drinking rum, you have had a stroke, precisely as I told you, and I have just, very much against my own will, dragged you head foremost out of the grave. Now, Mr. Bones..."
"That's not my name,"
he interrupted. "Much I care," returned the doctor. "It's the name of a buccaneer of my acquaintance, and I call you by it for the sake of shortness. And what I have to say to you is this. One glass of rum won't kill you. But if you take one, you'll take another and another. And I stake my wig, if you don't break off short, you'll die. Do you understand that? Die and go to your own place, like the man in the Bible. Come now. Make an effort. I'll help you to your bed for once." Between us, with much trouble, we managed to hoist him up the stairs and laid him on his own bed, where his head fell back upon the pillow, as though he were almost fainting. "Now, mind you," said the doctor, "I clear my conscience. The name of rum for you is death." And with that he went off to see my father, taking me with him by the arm. "This is nothing," he said as soon as he had closed the door. "I have drawn blood enough to keep him quiet a while. He should lie for a week where he is. That is the best thing for him and you. But another stroke would settle him."
Many thanks to Malcolm Grieve there for reading part two of Treasure Island.
Well, it's my pleasure to introduce a new poet in our poetry corner, Angie Belcher. Hello.
Hello, hi.
So you're not a local, a usual on our show, so I've been asked to have a little bit of a chat. So whereabouts do you live?
Tosserdown.
Tosserdown, wow, yes. Excellently Bristol. Were you there while they were filming Being Human?
I was, yes. I saw several of the vampires and the ghosts and people being extras, which is, it's like zombies around Tosserdown at that point, yeah.
Cool. Excellent. That sounds excellent. What are your inspirations for poetry then? What sort of stuff do you like to read generally?
I'm a performance poet, so I'm not really a page poet, so I tend to listen to people like Tim Key, Tim Minchin. Obviously, there's a Tim connection there somewhere. It'd be great if I had a third Tim, but no, people like that, really, yeah.
So do you like listening to sort of stand-up comedy and one-man, one-person shows and other stuff that's about sort of stand-up speech?
Yeah, yeah. So I do stand-up and I put poetry into my set, so I've got a lot of comedians that are my heroes as well, obviously, that I listen to and steal material from.
Okay. Who are your favourite stand-ups?
Gosh, it's difficult. I suppose Bill Hicks, that sounds kind of a bit kind of contrived, but I think his performance is something that I've watched an awful lot and thought, yeah, I want to look like him on stage.
Yeah.
And would also, obviously, like enough money to have his alcohol habit as well.
So do you find, what's the difference in reaction then between when you're doing stand-up and when you're doing poetry? Do people sort of think, oh, it's poetry now, so, you know, we sort of should sit quietly and responsibly, and it's more serious?
Right. Well, I suppose my poetry is funny, so it's not kind of got any great gravitas to it.
Yeah.
It tends to be things that I've listened people saying in pubs, or I walk past people and watch people, I'm a bit of a stalker and just write stuff down. So it is kind of, obviously it's supposed to be funny. But when I do the poetry in the gig, I don't do it straight off, because I think that would freak out a lot of my audience. So it tends to be that I do a bit of stand-up, then I introduce poetry throughout it, and by then I've got them on my side and they're happy to listen.
So how old were you when you started doing that, when you first stood up on the stage?
When did I first stand up on stage? I was a tree in The Wizard of Oz in 1986 on stage. That was the pinnacle of my career so far.
How old were you at the time?
I think I was about 8.
Before running the family or anything like that?
No. My dad's an electrician and my mum worked in a factory.
Okay, brilliant. We'll try us out with a poem then. What would you like to read first for us?
I've got a couple with me, and I've been told I have to give you my vanilla set. So this isn't the stuff you'd hear if you came to my gigs.
Okay, so you sort of stuff on stage out in public will be a bit more sort of
a bit
racy.
Different. Yeah, but this is my first poem is called, it was done for the Cheltenham Festival of Science last year. It's called A Tribute to Bryans.
Okay.
Bryans, how clever you are. Bryans, your multi-levelled lives leave me in awe. You teach us how basic forces determine our fate and that we all have a choice to make when at decision's gate. If you have two passions, which do you choose? Is it music or physics that you will use? Bryans, you have two very different paths, but one chose music, the other chose science and maths. This is the story of Brian Cox and Brian May that still teaches us stuff today. The Brian stories tell us what our dads did know. It is always useful to have more than one string to your bow. May's story tells us that deferred gratification can reap rewards. He waited 30 years to receive his PhD award. While Cox could have drifted into a drug-induced haze when D-Ream did fade, but in particle physics his life was laid. Both men knew your dreams should not be ignored. Your passions don't vanish, they just wait patiently at the door. Cox must have believed solidly that things can only get better because one day he's going to become a research fella. They both must have grieved for the careers they had missed. But then May cultivated his mullet while Cox became a particle physicist. The Bryans must have thought fame and fortune were out of their clutch. But now Cox is on the telly and May knows loads about space dust. For more of an idea as to the fate of these guys, we can find clues in their lyrics and lines. Because physics can be quite complicated. It's difficult to understand by the average Joe, but the Bryans make it simple, using language we all know. Whereas May wants the radial velocities of zodiacal dust clouds to be accessible, he wrote an explanation that Freddie did tell. I'm burning through the sky, yeah. 200 degrees, yeah. That's why they call me Mr. Fahrenheit. I'm travelling at the speed of light. I'm gonna explode. See, that's what happened in May's thesis about the solar system 4.6 billion years ago. Because Cox understood that one song can't make you, even if a political party wants to stake you. But Cox worked hard. He forgot about his keyboard. He went on to much greater things. And I don't need to remind you, he was the brains behind the Large Hadron Collider. As Cox says, our lives are full of emotional curiosity. We all seek to know where we've been, what is out there, what's in the ground. Is it space dust or fat-bottom girls that make the world go round? Because I'm just a poor girl. But I need no sympathy. I just want to know about the Big Bang and the theory of supersymmetry. But God knows, I'm really glad to have the Bryans in my life. To know that it's okay to have two things that you lust. To tell me about love, bicycles and interplanetary dust.
That was excellent. Thank you very much. I could tell you're used to being on a stage, like your feet were a little bit restless. Like, you know, you might want to have a bit of a move around. Like. So what would you like to read us next?
I recently did a gig for the Little Theatre Guild of Great Britain, so I wrote a poem especially for them, and I haven't really had an opportunity to do it again because it's quite specialist, but I think you might like it.
Okay.
It's called The Rules of Amateur Theatre. Now, you can't say good luck, and you can't say Macbeth. Now I'll get blamed for the AD's mysterious death. You can't say you can't make rehearsal or you haven't learnt your lines. You must slag off the director in the pub at closing time. Carry your script with you everywhere and a highlighter pen. Play at least four different characters and have four different hats to differentiate them. You must have shares in Leishner and Kirby grips, own your own character shoes and know how to tape up your tits. If you're the lead, you definitely can't brag. Make sure you point out your years in the chorus while you're outside having a fag. Now, the script will get cut, and then cut some more, and then those lines will get put back in again, and those lines will be changed, and that'll get cut again. Then they'll go back to the original just before opening night. My, how you'll curse the bloody playwright. You must stay true to the cause. You can't leave because you're moving to Leicester or you've got a promotion at your job at Greggs, and you definitely can't go professional because then we'll hate you. There are so many plays to choose from. Political, bedroom farce, or thriller. But mostly the choice depends on the demographic of your membership or the setting issues, which is why we don't do Peer Gynt. You must love Shakespeare or a collection of writers that may or may not have included Sir Francis Bacon. Chekhov when you're feeling lefty. Egbert if you just want to have fun. Few Guards for anarchy. Kane's a bit top shelf. Pinters for pauses. And Brecht if you just want to repeat yourself. I said Brecht if you just want to repeat yourself. Now, if you want to direct, you must have the right glasses and wear oversized cardies. Only pick the pretty skinny girls for the lead. There's no room for lardies. You must write copious notes and shout when people start shirking and have a really focused way of how you see the whole thing working. Where else do you get to have 30 hugs from strangers for talking and walking successfully for an hour? Good luck cards and flowers, your picky in the paper, your name in lights. For a week, you get to wear the same pair of tights. Stagehands must carry a minimum of 2 rolls of gaffer tape. The model of the set is always better than the real thing. The seating plan must have a nose-bleeding deucing and unsurmountable rake. Amdram is the most fun you can have, getting undressed in a drafty room of 30 other people. Endless hammering and costume tweaks. Where else do you get to snog the vicar in rehearsal for 12 weeks? Techies spend weeks making beautiful props that last just one rehearsal when on the floor it gets dropped. ADs make the tea and cook Sunday's breakfast because they've got to do something. Producers must moan about the tightness of the budget. If you spend more than you should, don't worry, just fudge it. Prompts, prompt, and tell you lines you already know. I was just pausing for effect. Don't you know? Warm up loudly in the wings. Breathe and articulate and sing me, 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 me. You must have a conspiracy theory about the dubious casting. Want a standing ovation that is everlasting? Because we just want to tell you a story. Want to move you in some way? Give us adulation and a glass flower tray. If in doubt, just upstage everyone. Shout louder and get a bigger hat, because amateur ain't lesser. We do it because we're crazy. We just want your love. And that is that.
Angie Belcher, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And now we have the regular What's On Guide, written and read by Jeff Sparks. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Thursday, 12th of May, John Otway and Wild Willie Barrett will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30pm and tickets are £10 in advance and £12 on the door. Into Friday, 13th of May, Atari Teenage Riot will be performing with support from Foe and also Necro Death Mort at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30pm and tickets are £15 in advance. Also on 13th of May, Cable Co will be performing at the Records Engineer in Temple Gate, Bristol. Gig starts around 9pm and entry is free. On to Song of the Week, and I present The Rolling Stones. In 2003, this album was ranked 7th on Rolling Stone magazine's list of the 500 greatest albums of all time. I'm of course talking about Exile on Main Street, and this is the song Rip This Joint. That was the Rolling Stones with Rip This Joint from the album Exile on Main Street. For more information, you can check out www.rollingstones.com. On Saturday 14th of May, Harlequin Singers will be performing at St George's in Great George Street, which is off Park Street in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30pm and tickets are £13 and also £11 and can be purchased via www.stgeorgesbristol.co.uk. Finally, on Sunday 15th of May, Last Carnival will be performing with support from Falling Into Difference at The Croft in Stokes Croft, Bristol. Doors open at 8pm and tickets are £5 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Many thanks, Jeff, there, for this week's guide to musical happenings in the fair city of Bristol.
That concludes this week's edition of Dialect. Many thanks to Martin Twinkletoes Evans for the lowdown on the professional wrestling scene in the USA, and also to Karen DeLapena, who talked to Anthea Page about the USA in the 70s.
Thanks also to Angie Belcher, who read us a poem, and Jeff Sparks with his What's On Guide. Features this week were by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. Mike Noyce was our engineer, and Alec Milne was the producer. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. So to you all, have a good week, and goodbye.
Want my bailout money, keep the bills coming. Sweet green cash just dripping like honey. I'm a new kind of thug with the Washington buzz, cause dealing bad pays better than dealing drugs. What do you think will happen when they double the money supply? A falling dollar makes it harder for you to survive, and take those billions and trillions and give it to their own kind. Hope you don't mind being wild blind. How do you think we got runaway credit? Ain't nothing going down unless the crooks in Washington let it. Now they regret it, but they still don't get it, cause the economy is crashing so bad, it needs a paramedic. I want my bailout money, yeah. Sweet green cash just dripping with honey, yeah. Gotta keep this economy running, yeah. I need another hit of my bailout money. Look at the stash, it's like a mad dash for the cash. They got the taxpayer taking it in the The CEOs, they are having a blast, while the working poor trying to make the paycheck last. The bailout money is created with new debts, while they're rolling in the limos and private jets. All the workers on the street, stripping sweat. White collar hustlers are taking everything they can get. They put the nation on a hyperinflation track. No presidential administration can take it back. And now the taxpayers picking up the slack. Like they put a high dollar big brother monkey on your back. I want my bailout money. Sweet green cash just dripping with honey. We gotta keep this economy running. I need another hit of my bailout money. With brothers caught on a $50 jack. But when Whitey take a trillion, the cops, they turn their back. The incompetent bankers, they get the jobs back. Cause those crankers, smoking money like it was crack. They take your car, your home, everything that you own. And when you're jobless and broke, you still gotta pay the loans. If you're thinking of stealing some food, please don't. Just go to Washington and you can steal everything you want. How we gonna solve this? Dissolve the big scam. We resolve, we won't let them steal from a fellow man. Raise your hands and ask, what is this? Then we put the Federal Reserve out of business. You take a look at a dollar bill. You see the eye above the pyramid looking back at you. That eye is laughing at you, suckers. I want my bailout money. Keep the car running. Sweet green cash just dripping with honey. We gotta keep this economy running. I need another hit of my bailout money. Aren't you tired of paying for that? Tired of breaking your back for that? Being oppressed and suppressed while you keep paying your tax for that? We gotta get out of this financial trap. And it's never gonna stop until you take your country back. The politicians are useless. Don't you know that they used us? And the bankers refused us. While the media skewed us. The authorities knew this. What's happening to us? Cause they make more money every time that they us. You didn't think they're printing all that funny money just for you, did ya? We are drowning in debt. But the Fed isn't done yet. What are we gonna get? Budget's in the red. Economy nearly dead. The politicians said that we're